Every person in this room has the perfect motive.
Stand back!
For murder.
What do you mean? Murder.
But only one of these suspects is the murderer. Is it the timid Mr. Green?
Why are you screaming?
Because I'm frightened!
Of what?
Screaming!
Or the militant Colonel Mustard?
If I was the killer, I would kill you next.
Huh?
I said if. If.
Mrs. White, who helped her husband on his way.
Well, it's a matter of life after death. Now that he's dead, I have a life.
Miss Scarlet, who's helped many men along the way.
Practice makes perfect.
Professor Plum, who's looking for a way.
I'm looking.
Mrs. Peacock.
I have absolutely no idea what we're doing here, but I am determined to enjoy myself.
Or did the butler do it?
No.
Paramount Pictures invites you to an evening of mystery.
Let us in! Let us out!
Murder.
This is getting quite serious.
And madness. In the movie that makes a scene of the crime.
Someone did it!
Clue. It's not just a game anymore.
Hello, and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And this week, we are talking about the 1985 mystery comedy Clue, directed by Jonathan Lynn and starring an all-star cast of great comedic actors. And, you know, if you want to talk about Clue, there's really one person that you need to talk to about Clue, and that is someone who has, as an avatar on Twitter, Madeline Kahn as Mrs. White. I can't imagine a greater tribute to the late, great Madeline Kahn than that. So, of course, we're talking about my friend Kim Cavill. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
I'm so thrilled to have you back again. Of course, you were here for when we talked about Secretary. And, you know, that was a movie that related to your work as a sex educator. But this is just, you just love this movie, right?
I do. This is the first movie I really remember even, because I saw it probably too young to even really understand it. But I remember, it's one of my clearest memories from childhood, honestly, seeing this movie. I kind of snuck into a friend's older sister's birthday party, and they had rented it from the video store, and I watched it in the back, and I just remember, like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And I loved it as a kid, and I've loved it ever since.
Interesting. I'm trying to think about what it is that a small child would necessarily get out of it, because it's set in the 50s, of course, and the style of humor is not, it's kind of old fashioned. So that's sort of interesting that in that year that would have been so appealing to a young child like that.
Well, so, you know, I'm one of those kids that people would say, oh, you're an old soul, you know, which I often joke about it. Like, I've been old since I was nine, you know, like,
right.
So it tended to be a thing that repeated, you know, throughout my life. My grandfather was forced to clean out his basement. I remember when I was in middle school, and he found a box of cassette tapes. And he was trying to give stuff away because he didn't want to throw it away. And the cassette tapes were all like Billboard top 20 songs from the 50s and 60s. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll take those cassette tapes. And I listened to nothing else for years. I loved all that music. And, you know, of course, when I started playing those tapes, I recognized some of the songs on the tapes from the soundtrack of this movie that I'd rented so much from the video store that they didn't even bother charging me for it anymore.
That's very nice.
And so, yeah, it's just I very clearly remember falling in love with it as a kid. And you know, I watched it again last night. I don't even know how many times I've seen it at this point, and it still makes me laugh like it's the first time I saw it.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's great. We can say that about any movie. I will admit, when I first saw, I didn't see it in the theater, but I saw it on cable, I guess, at some point not too long after that. And I will admit, the first time I saw it, I didn't like it that much because I am such a mega fan of 1975's Murder by Death, which is a similar theme. It's about a bunch of all-star comedians that go to this house, this creepy house, and it's sort of a murder mystery. And I sort of regarded Clue as like, this is kind of like a cheap jack version of Murder by Death. Murder by Death is a lot better, whatever. And then I sort of, I mean, this thing became a cable staple. And then over time, I kind of kept seeing it over and over again, not on purpose. It would just be on, or I'd see some part of it, and I'd go, oh, that was pretty funny. Oh, that's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. And now, eventually, I think when they re-released it in theaters 2 years ago as part of this classic series from the Cinemark movie chain, I went and saw it in the theater. Like, I paid to see it on the big screen. And it was funny all over again. I mean, this thing really does have one of the great casts of all time. We've got Eileen Brennan, who, of course, was in Murder by Death. She's the connecting link there. Tim Curry, the great Madeline Kahn. The word great is not big enough when you talk about Madeline Kahn. Christopher Lloyd, Michael McKean, Martin Mull, and Leslie Ann Warren, which, of course, this makes we're two for two for Leslie Ann Warren movies now. And they are all, for anyone who doesn't know the plot of this, they are all invited to this creepy house out in the middle of nowhere. The butler is Wadsworth, played by Tim Curry, and we start to find out that they are all in some form being blackmailed by a mysterious person. We don't know who that is yet. Then another person arrives, a Mr. Body, played by musician Lee Ving. Yeah, when there are other suspects, there's Yvette, the maid, played by the pneumatic Colleen Camp. Plus, there's a cook who we see brandishing a knife, played by Kelly Nakahara, who for most people remember playing Nurse Kelly on MASH. So she's in. I remember being a kid and being so excited that I saw somebody from MASH in a movie. I was like, "Oh, cool, this is Kelly Nakahara." And so, eventually, Mr. Body is murdered, like just like the game, just like the Parker Brothers game. A couple of times he's murdered, and then the whole thing is, well, who did it? It's now a whodunit at that point, and that sets the stage for this incredibly sort of wacky comedy of where things get increasingly histrionic as we try and figure out who's committing these murders, because then more bodies start piling up. So, I mean, what do you want to talk about first, Kim? Why do you love this movie so much?
I think I'm going to have to say the cast, I think, is what continues to draw me back and continues to make me laugh. I'm a huge fan of Murder by Death, too. And one of the things, I think one of the joys of parenthood is that there's a kind of a sweet spot before your kids get too old where they're just too cool for everything, you know, including your face, where you can kind of try and force your favorite parts of childhood back on them and say, like, look how cool this was. And I remember Murder by Death being part of one of the things my mom was like, no, you have to watch this. Yeah, Clue's good, but you have to watch Murder by Death. It was her favorite. And I really like that movie too. It's really tight. But this one, I think it's the cast that continues to draw me back, you know, especially Madeline Kahn, who I just adore. And, you know, Christopher Lloyd, hilarious. And I'm also a big Tim Curry fan. So I think it's the cast that continues to draw me back. And there's every time I watch it, I notice the little jokes fit in everywhere. So a lot of the jokes in Clue, you know, there's some big funny moments, but a lot of the jokes in there are small, and they're kind of like slivers. They're really sharp, but they're really short, and you kind of blink and you miss it. So every time I watch it, there's something else that's funny to laugh at. You know, because it's such an ensemble comedy, you know, each character gets their fair share of those, you know, those one-liners or those cutting remarks. And that's some of my favorite type of humor, humor that's really snappy and humor that moves really fast and that you have to be paying attention, you know, or you'll miss it. And so I think that's one of the things that I've always really loved about the movie, and the cast being as great as they are work really well together to deliver those kind of lines, because nobody's trying to show up another person. You know, they all bring such a strong comedic wit and talent and timing that it moves along, you know, in this really snappy, funny way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I noticed from watching it over again not that long ago was, I think both in terms of the pace, obviously the pace picks up as it goes along, and that's hard to do. There are a lot of movies that kind of hit that third act and they hit a wall, and that's really, you know, sometimes it can fall apart. But this, it gets more frantic as they go on, obviously, because, you know, not only does Mr. Body die, but more people die. And there's a singing telegram girl who shows up, played by the Go-Go's Jane Wedelin, of all people. She's shot instantaneously. I think she even gets like three words out of her song before she's killed. There's a cop played by the durable Bill Henderson, who you've seen in a million movies, City Slickers, Fletch, Inside Moves, Maverick, Silver Street, Buckaroo Banzai, he gets killed. But as it goes on, it gets sort of quicker and quicker, and that's one of the things I like about it. And the other thing I noticed is there's a running joke in the beginning of the movie where everybody thinks they're smelling something bad, and then they look at their shoe because they think that they step in like dog poop or something. And I admit, when I first saw that joke, I'm like, oh God, I don't like it. It's just, you know. And then, but the humor, I think, actually gets less broad as it goes on. And I almost wonder, is that because Jonathan Lynn, again, this is his first film, felt like in the beginning we had to kind of like get everybody on board and, you know, like get along with the premise and get moving, and then we can get a little more sophisticated. As I don't want to say it's not super sophisticated. It's not like this is some PBS special or anything like that. But I just wonder, it's like if you're trying to just get people like, okay, this is what – let's hit them with some broad stuff in the beginning, and then we'll get more into character later on. Because having watched this movie again, I noticed lots of little things that I never noticed the first like five times I've seen it.
Yeah. And I think the other part of that is the trying to engineer this sort of premise. You know, you're going to have this based on a board game. And that's the other thing. Like, I loved playing this board game. You know, so I'm the oldest of three sisters, and we're all fairly close in age. We spent a lot of time playing board games, and we all had our favorites. My youngest sister loved to play The Game of Life, which I mean, I thought was so boring. And my little sister really loved Monopoly. And within an hour of playing that with her, because she's very, very cutthroat, like we'd get in a vicious fight and have to stop. And so, and Clue was my favorite. And I really, you know, I was such a fan that for a while they sold this kind of advanced version of Clue. It didn't do very well. It was too complicated for a lot of people, but I loved it. It was called Museum Caper. And, I loved it so much that actually my sisters found a vintage version on eBay a few years ago and got me, you know, the board game so I'd have it here if I could play with my kids, if I can ever convince them to try one day. But, you know, it was my favorite game, and I love that even in the set, there's nods to the classic board game, you know, so the flooring they tried to make the same, the decor is attempted to kind of look the same as the actual game board, and then the secret passages connect the same way. And so that's another thing that I really liked about it, just being a fan of the game, and I love to see it come to life on the big screen. And so I think that one of the reasons it gets snappier as it goes along is because, you know, you have to engineer these people that don't know each other into this, you know, house for you know, a weird reason that you don't really understand until the end, and they don't know each other. And so it's going to feel, you got to do all this setup to have it make sense. And then I think the real turning point for the movie when the plot starts to pick up is after the second time that Mr. Body is murdered. You know, he's killed a couple of times, and Tim Curry is standing in the hallway, and he's just starting to get frustrated with all these people. And you can see that, you know, he's wanted everybody to come together, and this was all his idea, and none of these people are doing what he wanted them to do. And I love the frustration that appears on his face and in his voice. And he says, "I'm not shouting." And everybody just kind of looks and stares. And he's like, "Fine, I am shouting." And it's from that point on, it just gets really fast. Cause of course you also have the deadline of the police that are supposedly supposed to arrive, you know, within 45 minutes.
Right. He talks about that. He called the police. Right.
Yeah, so he says, "I call the police, they're going to be here in 45 minutes, so we better figure this out, and we better have our story straight before they show up," which kind of adds a deadline and makes the plot act like a snowball. You know, it has to get crazier and crazier and has to go faster on a deadline.
Right, and all the details from the game. I didn't play Clue that much as a kid. I tended to play Monopoly or other board games, but the other details, of course, all the murder weapons. When they get the noose, the gun, the knife. What are the other murder weapons? I forget.
They have a revolver. They have a revolver and a lead pipe.
Oh, the lead pipe. That's right.
Yeah,
yes.
And a candlestick.
And a candlestick. Yeah, that's right. They get all – and so each of them get that. And, yeah, this was the big hook of this movie, is that it was released in the theaters with three separate endings.
Yeah.
And apparently with each ending, it would be somewhat different. And I think that Clue was not a big hit when it played in theaters, I think, because most people probably felt like, I'm not getting the whole movie. You know, I'm getting part of the movie. And so the only version I've ever seen shows you one ending, and then you get this little title card where it says, that's how it could have happened.
Yeah.
And here's how it maybe happened. They show you a second ending, and then is it, but and then in the third card says, here's how it really happened. And it gives you, so you get all three versions. And to me, that's really the way that feels satisfying. I think if I had paid money to see this in a theater and I saw one ending, I would kind of be like, oh yeah, all right.
I agree. I mean, it did flop in the theater, but then as soon as it was released on video and, you know, started playing on cable, that's when it started to get an audience, you know, find its audience. And I think that's a big part of the reason. I would have felt the same way too. I mean, like, I get how that kind of gimmick might sound, and that's a big might sound appealing in like a focus group or a meeting of rich people that make movies that never actually go to the movies. I can imagine, you know, a bunch of guys standing around going like, oh yeah, yeah, that's a great idea. That'll really work.
And then, what a gimmick, you know?
Yeah. And then, you know, they do it and people are like, what was this? This, you know, like, come on, this sucked. You know, I have to go to three different theaters to see all the endings. Like that's not, you know,
No,
it's not going to work. But as soon as you put all those endings together, and that's how I saw it. You know, I was too young to go see it in the theater. I was born in 81. And so, you know, I saw it on video when I snuck into that birthday party to watch it. And I saw it the same way. You know, it plays all three of those endings in succession. And my, you know, when I was young, I remember my favorite ending was the one at the very end, the third, where everybody's kind of responsible. But on repeated viewings, you know, the other ones were just as entertaining.
Oh, yeah. No, they're fun. But, I mean, that third one – and it's funny when I – again, when I rewatched it, it's the third ending that has Madeline Kahn's famous ad lib where they ask her about Yvette because, of course, Yvette – for anyone, again, who hasn't seen this movie, she's played by the great character actress Colleen Camp. And they really play up Colleen Camp's physique in this movie. Her bosoms are constantly on display, and there's all these jokes about it. And she's in like a little short skirt, and she's always kind of parading around on high heels. And so,
yeah, I mean, they got her in a French maid's
outfit, right? And Madeline Kahn goes on this run about how much she hates Yvette, and it is so beautiful in its bizarreness.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Flay, I hated her so much.
Heaving breaths on the side of my face.
And so when I watched it, it dawned on me that if you had seen this movie in the theater and you got one of the other two endings, you wouldn't get that bit.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the funniest role in the movie is that ad lib.
I know, exactly. So, like, I can see why it flopped in the theater. I mean, that gimmick was just, it was a silly idea. But when you put it all together and you release it, you know, as I think it always was meant to be intended as those, because even when you put it all together like that and you're watching on video one after the other, because the plot snowballs so much and it just gets more and more chaotic and more in my opinion, funnier in part because of that chaos, it doesn't seem out of place for the movie to pull those kind of endings, you know, so it's seamless the way through. And then you see that character card and you think it's over and it says, well, that's how it could have happened. And then it cycles back to, I think it's like the last 12 minutes or so when it plays another ending. And by that point, it actually feels right in line with the rest of the movie, the way the movie feels, because it feels chaotic and crazy by the end. And so it kind of makes sense to go back and say, oh, okay, so it was something else. And to watch those, it just gets funnier and funnier with each one. But yeah, you're right. That famous bit at the end, which is one of the highlights of the movie and the performances, I would have felt so cheated to have gone to the theater and gotten, you know, had one of the other endings and not gotten to see it.
Yeah, I think it's Martin Mull who's behind her when she does that bit. And I'm just like, I'm wondering, is he trying not to laugh? Because everybody just knows, like, they're just letting her say whatever she wants. And I'm trying to imagine, one of the things I love discovering in movies, and sometimes I'm a nerd like this. I will go to IMDb and I will just sort of like troll around and follow links to see, you know, follow the careers of certain people and say, oh, look at this movie. I've never heard of this movie. Oh, who's in that? Oh, and then I follow there. And I'm always fascinated about directors in their first films because, you know, to have the confidence to direct a movie, you have to be pretty bold. You have to have a pretty decent-sized ego. But then to be – this is your first film, and then to have these all-stars telling them what to do – That's extraordinary. I mean, to be able to have the ability to kind of rein them in and say, okay, you know, because obviously there we've seen movies made nowadays where you hear for comedies, you know, they shoot 3-hour versions and then they just find it in the editing.
Yeah.
Sometimes those movies turn out well and sometimes they don't. But I would imagine if you have 6 all-star performers like this, actually 7 because you got Tim Curry on top of it, you have to really keep people focused, especially since there's so many scenes of them as a group interacting, running back and forth, constantly going from this room to that room. And one thing I did notice is I saw that Eileen Brennan was in relatively not great health by the time she had done this, because she was in a car accident, a very bad one, or nearly killed. And she took a long road to recovery. And they said, if you notice, she is always bringing up the rear in all the group running scenes. So she's just kind of hiding behind the ball, so that way nobody notices that she's way behind it. And once I saw that, I'm like, oh, yeah, I see that. She's always the last one. I always found that very funny.
And she's hysterical. I mean, and that's what the ensemble is so strong. You know, they each bring such a talent to their role, and they make the most of it because it is an ensemble. You know, there's not, I mean, Tim Curry, I guess, is arguably the lead, because he has, I think, the most, you know, if you add it up, the most screen time, the most lines. But, you know, they all have to make the most of their role as a team, and they're all hilarious. And Eileen Brennan, oh my God, when she, you know, towards the beginning, when someone says, you know, like, what if you were poisoned? And her reaction, which is just straight up hysteria that comes out of nowhere, you know, and she's just screaming and flailing her arms. And Mr. Green, you know, played by Michael McKean, has to kind of bring her over to the couch, and then he ends up smacking her across the face. And, you know, to describe it, it doesn't sound like it would be funny, but when you watch it, the performances are so strong and they're so tight. And that's why I laugh still every time I see the movie. You know, there's a laugh everywhere that you look. Sometimes they're really big and sometimes they're really small, but there's tight jokes everywhere you look. And some of it's just the physical comedy is really great too. And I'm not usually one for much physical comedy, but in this movie, it's very clever. And sometimes it feels a little bit inappropriate. And, you know, obviously, I mean, I was on here to talk about Secretary and I'm on here to talk about Clue. I like things that are a little bit dark and a little bit unexpected and a little bit inappropriate. You know, I like playing with those kind of sensibilities. And so I think that's another reason why I really, really love this movie.
I'm always impressed when an actor who knows they're in the scene, obviously, but they know that they're not the focus, is still reacting in a way that is appropriate for the scene. I mean, I guess most actors would say that's just you being professional. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen movies where there are actors in the background who are just staring off into the middle distance.
Yeah,
they know that, right, they're waiting to talk. Mm-hmm. And there is this moment with Eileen Brennan where Wadsworth is talking and he's explaining this whole thing about what he thinks, his theory of what happened. And he says something in the affirmative and she nods her head in the affirmative. And then he immediately contradicts himself by reversing himself. And then she nods her head the other way. Like she does this up and down and then, oh, no. Yeah, she says, oh, no. And it's something I didn't notice the first half dozen times I've seen this movie. And I'm like, that just makes me love her that much more, that she's present. She's in that ridiculous like outfit with those librarian Catwoman glasses. And so she looks very cartoonish, but I just love that little detail where she is doing this funny reaction and she's got to know that most people are not looking at her because they're looking at Tim Curry because he's the one talking.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the other person whose reactions I always appreciate in that movie too, is Mr. Green, is Michael McKean, because, you know, his character is gamely trying to play ball, but, you know, for reasons he reveals towards the beginning, he's also very, very uncomfortable. And he's, you know, he's a klutz. So he's like this tightly wound person who's trying desperately to pretend he's not tightly wound and he's actually totally relaxed. And so that comes across in everything. And if you look in the background in his face, he's always got that expression on his face. It's like, no, everything's fine. Everything's fine. But you can also tell very clearly that he knows that nothing is fine. It's not fine at all. And he's well aware and he's just trying to pretend. And his reactions are always really funny to me too, especially when Bill Henderson, when the cop comes in and Mr. Green kind of gets stuck leading him on a tour of the house while they're trying to trick the cop into not arresting anybody.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Yeah, they walk around, and so, I mean, they're using the dead bodies as props, and Mr. Green, this nervous, round-type person who's trying very hard to be polite, has this desperate smile on his face that always, always makes me laugh.
Oh, that scene where they go into the parlor, and they're using the dead bodies as props, and they're making it look like everybody's having a romantic assignation, and you see in that moment that Mrs. White is actually kissing Mr. Body's dead body. And I'm like, that's hit. Oh, my God. I mean, at least Christopher.
She wraps his arm around the bench. She's trying to make his arm.
Man. It's like at least Christopher Lloyd, when he has Yvette. Who does he have? The cook.
The cook. The cook's dead body.
He's just sort of got her on top of him, and he's rolling her around. But poor Mrs. White is literally kissing the lips of a dead person. Like, that's. Talk about like appropriate, like that's pretty ghoulish. And it doesn't surprise me when I noticed that this film was produced by Deborah Hill, who was, of course, John Carpenter's producing partner for many years. She produced Halloween. She produced The Fog. I mean, she was a great producer, and she, you know, was good at sort of putting stuff on screen that maybe was a little tough to take. I mean, it's all very silly, but still, when you think of it, it's like, I wouldn't want to do anything like that with a dead person. That would make me very upset.
And then, you know, you just watch this, you're watching it on the screen, and it just gets nuttier and nuttier. And, you know, of course, it's like, oh, my God, it's shocking. And Tim Curry, of course, is running around like a chicken with his head cut off because everything's totally out of control. And he has no idea what his guests have done. So he's not aware of what they've done with these dead bodies. And he's under the impression that the cop has just seen everything and that they're all about to get arrested. And the policeman comes out and says, why are you so nervous? Right. You know, this is a free country. He said, I didn't know it was that free. And that's one of the other things that I think I love about the movie is that there's that weird undercurrent, because of course it's like some nebulous time in the 50s. And when you first come into the house, you know, you follow Tim Curry into the house and he hears Yvette, the maid, who's polishing glasses, and she's, you know, dancing to music and stuff. And he turns that off and he's trying to make it serious. And then he goes to check on the cook and she's in there sharpening a knife, but she's also listening to the McCarthy hearings.
Right.
Back on the black and white television. And, you know, there's a couple of jokes in there about, you know, leftists, socialists and communists, and then J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah.
And that's a theme that I didn't really understand as a kid, but I picked up on, you know, later than one of the time. And it's something that still just really makes me laugh, because it's kind of like this just juxtaposition of, you have this bribery scheme going on. You have Tim Curry's wife, who theoretically supposedly committed suicide because of it. You have all these people that did what they're being blackmailed for. You know, you've got like war crimes and you've got selling of state secrets. I mean, these are all hideous things. And there's still a joke in there where, you know, they're like, but my wife, well, she had friends who were socialists.
That's my favorite line in the movie, is the reaction to that line.
God, no.
Yeah. Oh, God. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Oh, it's like the worst thing ever.
It's the worst. It's like bribery, nothing. Socialist, oh, God, now I'm offended.
The pause that Tim Curry puts in front of the word socialist is fantastic. All her friends were...
We all make mistakes.
Socialists. that's another thing in movies that I love, is when you have people overreacting to very dull piece of information. Like that always makes me laugh. Like in Young Frankenstein, when Dr. Frankenstein says, my grandfather's work was doo-doo, and the crowd's like, just that kind of like, I never fail to laugh at that. I'm just overreacting by crowd. So yeah, that is my favorite. That's not my favorite joke in the movie, and we'll get to that, but my favorite line is, her friends were socialists.
It's one of my favorites. And, you know, I think one of the other things that I appreciated, even as a young person, I did grow up seeing a lot of movies before I was probably, I should have been allowed to see them. You know, like my father never really adjusted to the role of being a dad. And so he didn't really see why anything in his life should change, which meant like I was watching Predator, you know, as soon as he had it on DVD. It didn't matter if I was six, like, you know, he wanted to watch Predator. So that's what he was going to watch. And so I grew up seeing, and he loved, you know, sci-fi movies. So he wasn't like a fan of Clue or anything, but, you know, just seeing Clue and not necessarily being able to understand a lot of the jokes at the age that I saw it, like, that was kind of my, I was used to movies like that. I saw a lot of movies where I didn't necessarily understand the jokes or what was going on until I was older and I could watch it again. So, you know, that didn't bother me so much, but I think it was the aesthetic of the movie that I really loved, and the female actresses in particular. Like, I loved that, you know, all of them in their own way, including Yvette. I mean, the cook we don't get to know very well, but including Yvette, have like a subversive kind of an element to them. You know, Yvette is, you know, this big busted French maid who's objectified through the movie. But even that being said, there's moments in there that make her a subversive kind of presence and character. So, like, you know, the characters have to pair up and search the house, you know, and of course they draw lots, and Yvette and Mr. Green, you know, are put together. And Mr. Green had shamelessly announced, you know, because again, this is the 50s and it was made in the 80s, that he was a homosexual, you know. And so you've got the gay guy and you've got the big busted French maid that are kind of stuck together. And then there's that time where they have to kind of squeeze up the attic steps and they don't trust each other. And so you're just watching this physical comedy bit that feels so subversive to me, just as this, you know, this objectified person, but they turn it into kind of a subversive joke. And that's true for Miss Scarlet. It's true for Miss Peacock. And of course it's true for Madeline McCann's character, Mrs. White, who's, you know, my personal favorite. And I liked that. I appreciate that every time I watch it.
I do appreciate, yeah, there was some stuff about it that, again, I've seen this movie for a movie that I didn't like that much when I first saw it. I've seen it, you know, like probably a dozen times at this point. It's like a popcorn. It just goes down, yeah, very easily. But the first, I don't know, one or two times I saw it, I was a little like, okay, you grew up, when I grew up, you know, when I did, gay jokes in movies were just de rigueur. I mean, they just were, you know, and you lived with them. And now you see them now and you kind of grin, oh boy, you know. Yeah. And then I kind of watch this and I go, but you know what? The gay jokes that they're making, the movie itself is not making the gay joke. The character is. And that's, yeah, different. The movie isn't endorsing the joke. I mean, obviously, again, this is set in the 50s. So someone being a openly homosexual would have been very scandalous, especially, yeah, with, you know, when you know what J. Edgar Hoover was doing and what we know about, yeah, him now. But I realized that, like Miss Scarlet has the line where he says, Mr. Green says, I'm a plant. And she says, a plant? I thought people like you were called a fruit. And it's like, yeah, okay, it's a funny line, but the movie itself is not getting off on that joke. It's presenting her in a particular view, and that's a big difference, you know. That's,
yeah,
a big
difference. And you got to remember too, he's the one character that the only character, including all the ones that got shot, including the call girl, that character is the only one who legit didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Like, he wins the end of the movie. Like, he wins at the end. There's no solution that implicates him at all. Like, and so, yeah, spoiler alert, but for anybody who hasn't seen it, but it's, you know, he's the one character that did nothing wrong. And so you're right. Like, the movie doesn't take that and then make a joke of that, make a joke of his sexuality. They don't even use his sexuality to malign his character or keep running gags through the movie. It's kind of mentioned in the same kind of aside as every other kind of detail about every other character we meet. I mean, Elaine Brennan's character, Mrs. Peacock, you know, sneaks into men's restrooms and leaves top secret, yeah, papers for her lobbyists to find and then sells her senator husband's vote, you know, for money. And that's just the beginning. You know, you have all these other characters that have, and then Madeline McCann's character, Mrs. White, theoretically kills her husband. So, you know, you just find these sorts of things out about every single character. And so, yeah, the movie doesn't twist it into a joke that, you know, even aside from, you know, things, sensibilities change over time and it's made in 85. But if it had made jokes like that and it was a running gag through the movie, I wouldn't feel about it the way that I feel about it, right, now. You know, I still love it.
I like how Miss Scarlet is, she's a madam, and I like that she's not particularly ashamed of that. She's like, hey, that's what people want. I do it. And so, and she has a real I mean, Leslie Ann Warren, we talked about this on the Secretary episode, is really underrated, I think, and has a really wonderful comic energy in virtually all the things that she's been in. And she has a real vivacious energy here. And it was funny when I learned that originally this was going to be played by Carrie Fisher, who had to drop out. And look, I love Carrie Fisher. Anyone my age, anyone who grew up on Star Wars and the Blues Brothers and When Harry Met Sally, I love Carrie Fisher. That said, I can't picture Carrie Fisher in this part because Carrie Fisher's persona was not one of kind of a sex pot. And I mean, you know, the metal bikini aside, that was not really her part. But Leslie Ann Warren was really good at that. She's very sexy in Victor Victoria. And so to me, it's like, I just can't picture Carrie. I mean, Carrie Fisher's very, very funny, and she would have been funny in the part. But to me, Leslie Ann Warren brings something different than Madeline Kahn, Eileen Brennan bring. And that contrast helps, I think, makes it a better movie.
I think what I like about it, is that, you know, I'm thinking about it. I think that I've always liked that the women, the female characters, are every bit as dangerous as the men.
Right.
And I think that's what I've always really liked about it. Because, you know, that's, it's unusual. I mean, it is. It's unusual without just kind of putting a gun, you know, being really lazy about it and giving her a gun. And then she kind of makes up the difference or whatever. But, you know, there's only one revolver in this movie, and, you know, Miss Scarlet and Wadsworth are constantly arguing about how many shots are
2 + 2 + 1 + 2. 2 + 1 + 1.
But I think that's what I really liked about, I've always really liked about it too, is that all of the women are every bit as dangerous as the men. And it makes it funnier to me.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the three male actors are, I'd say, I mean, it's absolutely an ensemble film of all seven actors. And I would agree with you. Tim Curry is ostensibly the lead because he drives the plot. He's the one who's always running them around. From here to here. But in individually, I would say that the three actresses probably get more funny bits to do and are probably a little more just compelling on screen. I mean, Martin Mull kind of plays, you know, he's Colonel Mustard. He's kind of a baby. He's like a big baby. He even has a line about my mommy and daddy. And I'm like, my God, he's a grown man. He's talking to them like that. And Christopher Lloyd is pretty reserved as Professor Plum. And I said, Michael McKean is great, but they're just less, I don't know, they pop a little less than the three women. And I think that's probably by design. But I would say that in terms of the, who I would say is the main characters, I would give the women kind of the nod. It would be Tim Curry first, then the women, then the men. To me, that's sort of the level of importance of just how the story plays out, until, of course, the end, where you find out that Michael McKean has been playing everybody all along. But it's – and that's unusual, you know, for a movie. And especially when you think about this movie, you know, based on a board game. When you first hear that – and this was – nowadays, they make movies about every – you know, everything, Disney rides, and it's all grist for the mill and it's fine. But in 1985, I think people were still kind of rolling their eyes a little that you would deign to make a movie out of a board game. Like, that seemed a little cheap, didn't it? You know, but they actually, you know, it has its own unique kind of energy to it. And that's what makes it so enjoyable.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it honestly, in some cases, and, you know, Murder by Death, to me, feels the same way. In some cases, it almost feels like you're watching a play.
Yes.
You know, and that's how tight the screenplay is. Like, that's how tight the scripts are in both of those films, and that's how snappy the jokes are. And I think because in both films, the ensembles are also so strong. You know, the casting in Murder by Death was also fabulous. So I think that's part of it too. Is that it was made by, you know, based on a board game, and it is another kind of, I'm sure it felt like a cheap gimmick, but I mean, the screenplay is tight, and it's so tight. It feels sometimes still at moments like I'm watching a play, especially now that they've re-released it like on Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And I normally don't really care that much about, you know, Blu-ray versus, like, I just don't, but this is one of those movies that I really did appreciate watching on Blu-ray because there was so much more detail in the set, and it just seems to glow, and it feels almost like, this does feel quite a bit like I'm almost, you know, I'm at a theater watching a play. Like, that's just how fast paced and snappy it is.
Yeah, this thing has again, I think it's probably got to be the work of Deborah Hill as well. There's a good platform for the comedy, and that I like horror comedies. It's hard to do.
Yeah.
Like Shaun of the Dead, I think, is one of my favorites. But it's
I love that movie.
Yeah, when you do it right, or Ghostbusters, where it's like the horror elements are real, but the comedy is there too. And like, I love the music in this film. It's by a guy named John Morris, who did Ironweed, Spaceballs, mm-hmm. Dirty Dancing, Johnny Dangerously. His most recent credit is something called Clue Presentation Short. I have no idea what that is. I'm assuming maybe they are working on a remake.
They are.
Okay, well, I want to address that near the end of the show. We're going to talk about the remake. But, I mean, I like – the music is very, very memorable and very kind of – it's not – it's – I don't know. It's not a horror score, but it's got elements to it that make it seem like it works for a thriller, a lighthearted thriller. And that's what it's not a comedy score as much as I can sort of talk about music, which I'm not really qualified to do. But between that and like – the one full shot we get of the house, which is this nice matte painting, which is when the power goes out. Like, that matte painting could work in a horror movie. It's not it looks genuine, and I like that verisimilitude that it has.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same. I think the music also, it turns up the suspense a little bit. And so it kind of helps the movie balance that, it's funny. And you've got all these crazy people in here in this bizarre situation, and they're just kind of fumbling around, in the dark, as it were, to try and figure this out. But at the same time, like, there's actual suspense too. You know, there's suspense in the movie because everybody in the house is in danger, and nobody knows. Just like the point of the actual game, nobody knows, who to fear. So of course, in those situations when you don't know who to fear, you really just fear you fear everyone. You know, you suspect everyone, and you suspect everything. And there's a lot of comedy, but also suspense that comes out of that situation. And the music, I think, is a really good balance for that too. Like, you have these kind of long sustained minor chord high points in moment and kind of lulls where you've got characters that are creeping around the house trying to be sneaky. And then at the same time, when people start running around and Tim Curry's like, no, I know how it's done. Come on, you have to show, and then it picks up and you have violins kind of frantically strumming along in the background too. So I think the music is great. It does a really nice job of matching the mood of the film. Like, and I'm the same way. Like, I really love comedy horror. And so maybe this is when I fell in love with it. You know, I hadn't even thought about it like that, but I'm a pretty consistent fan of that genre.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, those are two genres that are all about surprise, and one is kind of a positive surprise, and one is a sort of a negative surprise, but they both work on the same idea of shocking you into a reaction, and so when you can get them both together, it really works well. I mean, the scene where the motorist is killed, and we haven't mentioned him to this point, that's the other guest that shows up, this quote-unquote abandoned motorist, that has some genuine suspense to it, because he's talking on the phone.
Yeah,
and he said, the funny thing is, well, and then he gets killed. But I mean, that has like, there's no comedy in that bit.
No.
He just flat out gets killed. And I have to mention this too: the motorist is played by Jeffrey Kramer. Now, a lot of you probably don't know that name, but you have seen him. He is the deputy in Jaws. He is Roy Scheider's assistant in Jaws. And oddly enough, Jeffrey Kramer has led a very strange life because he is now out of acting, and he is Bob Dylan's manager.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so now there are connections to MASH and Bob Dylan in this movie, which are like all of my other podcasts. So like all of my interests are like, coalescing here in this movie. It's remarkable. It's remarkable how well it works. Also, when you know that they had to kind of mess with this a lot, because apparently there was a fourth ending to this movie, and it was scripted and shot, and it's where we find out that Wadsworth committed all the murders in a twisted need for perfection in his life, and he ends up running away, and he gets killed by the dogs, the dogs that live outside, and they realize that is a little too grim to have, in this comedy, someone ostensibly getting murdered by dog, eaten to death by dogs. So they cut that whole bit out. But it's amazing how well it works. And I found this little piece, which I thought is amazing, that ending shots of it survive in the novelization. There was a novelization of Clue. Mm-hmm. And the storybook, which actually features a photo from that shot. And once I saw that there was a Clue novelization, I was like, I want to read that. That entertained me. So I went on to eBay and I found a copy, but unfortunately it was $190.
Oh my God. See?
So I was like, I don't need
too
to know that
bad. Like me on the earth.
Yeah. So I had to pass on that, but I thought that was really interesting that they originally had that. And also another part of the ending that was edited out was Mrs. Peacock. When we find out, I think it's the second ending that Mrs. Peacock did it. She gets shot by Howard Hessman. Who, of course, mentioned this movie. And they said if you watch the movie, and I wasn't able to see it, but they said you can literally see a scene of smoke in the air on the outside, and that is the smoke from the gun that was fired to shoot Mrs. Peacock.
Oh.
And they realized that was too grim. And so you hear they had to go back in and do some ADR where she says something about, I'm a senator's wife. And if you watch that scene, you never see her saying it. They had to dub it in later to remind, yes. She's not dead. She's still alive. She's just being arrested.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, I love learning new things. Yeah. I didn't know that at all. I knew about the mysterious kind of lost fourth ending, but I didn't know about the novelization. And I certainly didn't know about Miss Peacock, Mrs. Peacock being shot. Yeah. That's crazy to think about.
I would love to read the novelization, but yeah, that kind of money, I can't justify that. It's a little much, guys. Come on.
A little steep.
Yeah. A little much. Yeah.
So I was just going to say, and that's one of the other things. So her ending in particular, I like how the FBI director kind of comes up to the house. You know, he's the person and he pretends to be a Jehovah's Witness.
Right. The kingdom of heaven is at hand.
And she's like, oh, go away. And slams the door in his face. And that's what I mean. Like every single character, as you know, even if they only get two lines, the two lines that they get are a joke. You know, it's really that tight. And I just love that about the movie.
I find that really creepy, that one moment where she goes outside and Howard Hessman is there and he says, Mrs. Peacock. And she goes, how do you know my name? I always find that creepy in movies where someone knows a piece of information that they shouldn't know, and then they reveal it to that person. I always find that very chilling. There's just something about that, you know, we now know that, the Howard Hessman character is not genuine. I mean, you know he's not, obviously, because he's dressed in, like, a suit. Why would he be, you know, you're not driving around to this house with your chick tracks in that kind of outfit. But nevertheless, there's just something about the way he says, Mrs. Peacock, and then it dawns on her that he should not know who she is. I was like, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, it's creepy. Yeah.
Another detail that's very, very strange, and again, it took many times to notice this, is that Mr. Body, which is played by the musician Lee Ving, he's entirely dubbed. His whole performance is dubbed. I don't know why. Maybe maybe they didn't like his performance at the time and they had to go back and do it, but he's a weird character. He's not an actor. I mean, he's not a professional actor. So he has a weird energy in this movie, in the middle of all these very professional, you know, actors that know what they're doing. He feels weird. And there's something even more to me discordant about the fact that I recognize that his voice is not really coming out of that mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I know that, you're totally right. He sticks out kind of like a sore thumb, which I mean, okay, for his character, I guess kind of makes sense. So, you know, it's okay. And, he's only in there for the beginning of the movie being Mr. Body, you know, for a reason. But I do know that, I remember I had looked it up at some point, but I think that, the director, you know, didn't really want him to play that part. But, I think the studio kind of foisted him upon the movie. And
what a weird choice.
Yeah. And Jonathan was like, well, I guess, it's a small, I got to say yes for whatever reason to this. So I think that probably adds to, you know, the weird nature. And, you know, he does, he doesn't show up with everybody else. He kind of just wanders in at dinner, you know, that hilarious dinner scene, which I love when you've got Mr. Peacock and Mrs. White, they're slurping their soup and they're just, and everybody else has that look on their face, like, really, this is what I have to listen to. And then you've got Aline Brennan, who, talks, you know, who gushes over the recipe, which is obviously disgusting to everybody else at the table. And then in wanders, you know, this weird guy, and nobody really knows who he is. And so he's strange when he appears. He's strange the whole time that he's there. And I think that that must have been true offset as well.
Yeah, he just said he's this disruptor in this story, and it works on a meta level because he just doesn't fit with everybody else. Everybody else just seems so comfortable on camera, and then he kind of wanders in, and his weird, almost zoot suit kind of thing. I can't picture why.
Spangly jacket.
It's very, very odd. Aside from the Madeline Kahn's with the flames on the side of my face, do you have a particular favorite joke from this movie? Because I know what I'm thinking.
So there's a couple, and you know, they're mostly, I love Miss Scarlet too. You know, I think most men need a little practice. Like I love that. But I think for me, it's Madeline Kahn. I love when she's being questioned about her disappearing husbands, and she's like, you know, well, he was a rather stupidly optimistic man. I mean, I'm afraid it came as a great shock to him when he died, but you know, I love that. And I loved when Wadsworth said, you know, but your husband before that, he disappeared. And she said, well, that was his job. He was an illusionist, but he never reappeared. He wasn't a very good illusionist. I love that too. But my very, very favorite joke is with Mrs. White in the kitchen talking to Colonel Mustard. And she says, husbands should be like Kleenex, soft, strong, and disposable.
When you laugh really hard at that, does your husband kind of like, oh, okay, I give you a little bit of a side eye, or like what? I mean, you can't laugh that hard at that joke.
It just kills me. That joke just kills me every time. And to a close second would be, again, she's talking with Colonel Mustard, who does just kind of play this bumbling guy. He's always bumbling and making stupid remarks. And everybody else just kind of low-key tolerates him. And she says to him, you know, nobody's really talking to her. She just kind of jumps in and says, life after death is as improbable as sex after marriage.
I feel like a lot of your career is playing into your appreciation of these particular jokes, Kim.
It's just, I love it. I just love those jokes so much. I mean, they kill me. And then, of course, her bit at the end with the flames on the side of my face. It's just so bizarre and out of left field and funny. That, you know, it just does. It makes me laugh every time that I see it. I don't think it matters how many times I see the movie. It's still funny.
Yeah. My favorite gag is actually a visual one. It's after Yvette has been killed. She gets the noose around her neck.
Yeah.
And she is laying dead on the pool table. And it's at a certain point where all the actors are now together after they've split up and they found the secret passageways. And by the way, secret passageway in a fireplace. How does that work? But okay. they've all gotten together. And they've just kind of gotten used to how awful this night is because they're dealing with all these dead bodies and all this violence. And they walk into the room, see Yvette laying there dead. None of them realize she's dead until that moment. They all walk in and they make no remark, and they all turn in unison and just walk out. That makes me laugh every time, of just this kind of like, huh. And then they just walk out. They don't even care. The bodies are piled up so much that it just doesn't even matter anymore. That makes me laugh so hard. I'm just
worn down. Yeah.
Yeah, that shruggy reaction is just absolutely fantastic.
Because they've just been through hell. You know, like earlier in the night, Wadsworth makes them drag all the bodies into the sitting room.
Yeah, right.
And they're asking, like, why are we doing this? He's like, I'm a butler. I like to keep the kitchen and dining room tidy, you know? So they're dragging all these corpses, but then by the time they get to a vet, they're just like, whatever, you know, like, whatever. And then that's, you know, that goes to Colonel Mustard's best joke in the whole thing. It's like, you know, one of the characters asks him, is everything okay? And he says, yep, two corpses, everything's fine. And then
this is the new reality that we're dealing with here.
Yeah. I love that too. It's a great gag.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also couldn't help but notice, this is the very last thing I will mention, is Eileen Brennan faints in both movies, this and Murder by Death. Like, she has a comedy faint. And I have to wonder, is that a nod to Murder by Death? I mean, what are the odds that she would be in two drawing room comedy thrillers, and then she does the same exact thing, which is a kind of catch me, and nobody catches her either way. So there's just something about making Eileen Brennan faint, which is very, very funny. She was just good at that.
She is.
And then I love the end credits. First of all, the version of Shake, Rattle, and Roll is just great. I love that song. It's just a really fun song. But then seeing all the characters on their clue cards as they turn, and I just think this is a really great, nice, stylish way to wrap up this movie. Like, to me, it really brings a lot of great energy to wrap this thing up. It's terrific.
I loved it too. You know, and this is before they did any of that Easter egg stuff, or, you know, before, you know, now you kind of have to sit in a movie and you kind of have to turn and ask yourself, like, okay, is there a thing that I'm supposed to sit here for?
Right.
You know, because it happens so often, but that's not a thing that happened before. But the credits are so entertaining that, you know, and even when you play it, I remember this happening, you know, at this birthday party that I snuck into, like, they're so entertaining that you want, and the song is so good that you want to watch them, you know, and there's something really mesmerizing and interesting about it. And it's so simple, you know, it is just, it's a really, really simple idea, but it's very elegant, and it's, you know, it's great. It's a great way to tie up the movie, which is just kind of, it's a little gem. That's what it feels like for me. It's just like this little gem that, like, you know, like you were saying, like popcorn, like I can just come back to every couple of years and watch it and laugh at these tight jokes and this really wonderful cast. I mean, I miss Madeleine Kahn. So it's just kind of like a, I don't know, it feels in a weird way like coming home, you know, because I've been watching it for so long as well since I was a kid. It's just, it's always going to be one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a really great collection of actors. And that leads us to the talk of this remake. Supposedly there's Jonathan Lynn on IMDb. He has this same thing, this Clue presentation short listed on his IMDb profile. And so I can imagine that they are working on a remake. I mean, you know, can they do, could you remake this? Of course you could. You can remake anything. But yeah. Is there a stable of comedy kind of all-stars that exist now that would make a film like this appealing? I mean, I think that's part of the reason Murder by Death works so well is that you're like, wow, it's David Niven and Peter Sellers and Elsa Lanchester and James Cook, like these amazing people all in the space. And then here you've got Madeleine Kahn and Michael McKean, like really great people all together. Is there a sort of millennial, you know, 21st century equivalent of that group of comedians that could bring this off? I mean, I guess there is. I can't imagine it, but
weird argument. I think that there is, but I think that it's not necessarily people that are famous for being comedic. I think there are some actors that have really great timing and a dry kind of delivery that I don't see every movie that's made, obviously, but I don't think a lot of movies with that particular comic lens get made very often. You know, they're not budget busters, really. They're not huge in your face comedies, but, you know, like, for example, this is going to sound, you know, crazy. It sounds crazy to people when I say it, but like Daniel Radcliffe, for example, is hilariously funny, and he's really, really funny, but he's famous for playing Harry Potter. And,
right,
you know, when he gets the chance to be funny, he's very funny. He's very funny in this kind of dry, droll, sharp-witted kind of way. But don't make a lot of movies that have that kind of comic sensibility. And, you know, I think with the way that studios have to prioritize with their budgets, you know, it's hard to cast the guy who played Harry Potter in a comic.
Sure.
And so, you know, I know that one of the actors that is involved in the remake, you know, is Ryan Reynolds, who's probably the big guy that's, you know, that's quote unquote famous for his quote unquote sarcastic humor. And so that's what kind of makes me, you know, take a step back and you know, I'm a natural skeptic anyway.
Right.
You know, to think, oh, okay, well, I don't know about that, you know, because I do find Ryan Reynolds is funny. He's, you know, I laugh. Sure. He's funny, but the at least the movie as I know and love it is a movie that needs team players. You know, like
right,
an ensemble to work. You can't just cast what the droll, like Robert Downey Jr. You can't just cast Robert Downey Jr. in the role of Wadsworth and have him do kind of the throwaway lines that he does, like in Sherlock Holmes or in the Iron Man movies, and then call it the same, you know, call it an ensemble comedy. Like it's not going to be successful that way. So I think there's talent out there. I'm just not sure. I'm more dubious of a studio being willing to cast the talent that is out there to make the movie, you know, at least as I know and love it.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, I hope that if they do it, that they maybe get a nod, bring a nod to the other version and bring one of these actors in. I mean, Leslie Ann Warren, Michael McKean, Martin Mull, Christopher Lloyd, they're all still around. They're all still working. I mean, Tim Curry's around, but I think I read that he's in relatively ill health, unfortunately. But yeah. a lot of these other actors are still around, and I would love to see a little nod to this version by bringing somebody from that film in, especially, I think, Leslie Ann Warren, just because I think she's just vastly underrated.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see her in more stuff. So yeah, it's Clue. It's a movie that, you know, like I said, it took me a while to sort of appreciate, but now I really enjoy it. And this was not a movie that I sort of could picture covering on the show, because it's sort of like, what is there to talk about it? But I just wanted to talk to you because I enjoy talking to you so much on Twitter and stuff, and we had such a good time on Secretary that I'm really thrilled that you came back on the show to talk about it. This was a blast.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk about it. You know, it's been one of my favorites, and you know, there's lots of people like me out there too. You know, it's crazy how much, you know, it is crazy anytime, like you know, my avatar is Mrs. White, and I just assumed when I put it on there that nobody would really know the reference, like who that is or why I chose it. And then every once in a while, I'll use, you know, GIFs from the movie because they're some of my favorite. You know, if you're ever looking for reaction GIFs,
right.
Mine, you know? And I just assumed that it would be like, there'd be a handful of people that would know what I'm talking about. But then, you know, I'll tweet about it and I have all these people that'll say like, I love that movie. And then even yesterday, I have to tell you, like even yesterday when I went to my public library to get the Blu-ray copy, because I don't own it yet, I wanted to go borrow it to watch it again. Even when I got that copy and I took it up to the counter to check it out, the person checking it out was like, oh my God, I love this movie so much. And she was like, and then she started quoting lines, you know, she started running lines and just one after the other and then laughing. And I would feedback and give her those lines. And she's like, oh, and I had my kids watch it. You know? So it seems to slot right in there. And there are a lot of people like me that for whatever reason, and you know, have fallen in love with this little gem of a movie. So I really appreciate you having me on to talk about it.
Oh, no problem at all. Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter, so my handle is sexpositiveparenting, and my website is tnintimacy.com. That's my professional website. You know, I teach sex education, and my email address is sexpositiveparent@gmail.com.
Outstanding. I said we'll have that link in the show notes. So thanks, everybody, for listening. This was always a blast. I said, Kim, I would love to talk to you about any movie you ever want to talk about. So we'll have to get to another Leslie Ann Warren movie.
I agree. That should be good.
That would be good. Victor Victoria is the obvious example, but I have another one in mind that we'll have to talk off air about because it's a bonkers movie. It might be fun to talk about, and we'll just continue on with our Leslie Ann Warren Film Festival.
Excellent. That sounds promising.
Cool. So, everybody, thanks so much for listening. Of course, you can find back episodes of the show on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher, and we're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
I'm sure. You were jealous that your husband was stripping her that. That's why you killed him, too.
Yes. Yes, I did it. I killed Yvette. I hated her so much. Flames on the side of my face, breathing, breath, heaving breaths.